Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Fort Hood gunman had his full support. The alleged would-be Baltimore bomber last week called him a beloved sheikh, says the FBI. The U.S. government has painted a big assassination target on his back. Anwar al-Awlaki, the charismatic American cleric in Yemen, is inspiring, we're told, a steady stream of young Americans to reach for terror in the name of Islam. This hour on point, the drumbeat of FBI allegations, apparent intended attacks, and the influence of Anwar al-Awlaki. You can join the conversation. Has your head been turned by all the alleged thwarted attacks in the news? The attacks that happened. Do you know the influence of al-Awlaki? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Scott Shane, who covers national security for the New York Times. Scott, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us from Washington is Chris Heffelfinger, researcher and analyst of militant Islam for the Combating Terrorism Center at the U.S. Military Academy, West Point. From 2006 to 2008, he instructed the FBI in how to identify radical Islam and Islamic militants. His forthcoming book is Radical Islam in America, Salafism's Journey from Arabia to the Midwest. Chris Heffelfinger, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Scott Shane, first to you. Introduce us to Anwar al-Awlaki. Who is he? What's he up to? And is he a big deal?
I think he is a big deal. He was born in the United States because his father was a graduate student, and therefore he's an American citizen. Spent the first 7 years of his life in the U.S., then went back and attended school in his ancestral country of Yemen with his father, who went on to be a fairly prominent citizen. He was Minister of Agriculture and Chancellor of two different universities. And he then was sent back by his father, who had gotten himself an agricultural science degree in the U.S., to pursue, similar course, to pursue an engineering degree at Colorado State. And he did earn that degree. But when he graduated, he decided that he had become quite religious, and he found that he had a little bit of a knack for preaching. And so he became an imam in a series of American mosques, and he left engineering behind. There are two theories about his development after that, mm-hmm. and we can talk about those. One would say that he was a secret agent of al-Qaeda from an early stage, and only later revealed his true views. I spent a lot of time looking into his biography and talking to people who'd known him in the U.S., and I think actually his views evolved and gradually changed. He became very radical, moved to London, then moved back to Yemen, and gradually took the position that he has had in the last couple of years of calling for jihad against the United States, justifying the murder of Americans on religious grounds, and inspiring a series of, or helping to inspire a series of terrorist plots in the U.S., in Canada, and Britain. I think it's his sort of Americanness and his fluent, idiomatic American English that actually make him stand out from the crowd of sort of jihadi ideologues. And that's what's made him, a very popular figure in this movement.
Chris Heffelfinger, the Obama administration clearly takes Anwar al-Awlaki seriously. They have a kill order out now on this American citizen. Just last month, the federal court in Washington, signed off on this. I guess that means he could be assassinated any way, any time in Yemen or wherever they find him. The FBI, in this series of Alleged thwarted bombing attempts that we've been told about. Baltimore last week, the Portland Christmas tree lighting before that, the Washington subway. Not every time, but again and again, his name comes up from the FBI as having been behind inspiring young Americans to get involved in these situations. How significant do you see his influence being, Chris?
I think he is very significant. He's been involved in terrorist cases in the U.S. going back to the Fort Dix case in 2006, 2007. There was the Toronto 18, where he was also very highly regarded among the suspects in that case. And at least, a dozen moving forward, many of them were individuals. Most recently, I think one of the most interesting cases we've come across was that of Roshanara Chowdhury, who stabbed her member of parliament, Stephen Timms.
This is in the UK.
Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm. And she said that she had no contact with other radicals, any other imams or individuals. She'd spent, according to her, 5 months listening to everything that Al-Awlaki recorded, all of his video and audio recordings that are available online. And so that case could potentially be the first person who was radicalized strictly online, on the web. And this is certainly a new phenomenon. Now, moving forward from there, the last issue of Inspire magazine, which is the first English language jihadi magazine to come out. He's featured very prominently in that second edition, which came out last fall, late September, I believe. And there, I think he's sort of suggesting a new model for jihadi activism that we haven't seen before. It's a pretty dramatic shift from 5 or 8 years ago, in the years immediately after 9/11, where he's talking about individuals taking it upon themselves, not consulting with any sheikh or Islamic authority, and going out and killing Americans on their own. And this, sort of what we call lone wolf, I guess, terrorism, is much harder to prevent from a law enforcement perspective. And that's what we've been seeing more and more often with all the cases that you just mentioned, individuals that aren't tied to any cell or certainly not tied in any meaningful way to Al-Qaeda Central.
Let's get a sense of the message of this man, an American citizen in Yemen who has been all over the Internet, hasn't been hard until lately when YouTube withdrew a whole lot of Awlaki's videos. We'll talk about that. But here's a bit from a 2008 lecture entitled, It's a War Against Islam. And Anwar al-Awlaki emphasizes, he says that the America's war on terrorism is nothing more than a war, he says, against Muslims.
This is not now a war on terrorism. We need to all be clear about this. This is a war against Muslims. It is a war against Muslims and Islam. Not only is it happening worldwide, but it's happening right here in America, that is claiming to be fighting this war for the sake of freedom while it's infringing on the freedom of its own citizens just because they're Muslim.
Just because they're Muslim. I mean, Chris, how do you hear the appeal in that? What's calling out to the lone wolf, as you put it, in American society there? After 9/11, there was both tension around the American Muslim community and a significant effort to reach out and embrace fellow citizens. Why would this message be, it seems like, drawing a growing, I don't know what the word is at this point, trickle, stream, drumbeat of, people ready to step up and at least with FBI handlers around them, go for the bomb?
Yeah. I think part of this is that he's, in a sense, a middleman for the jihadi message. This is a message that's been very steadily put out there online and through a series of publications that Muslims all over the world, particularly in Gaza and Chechnya, in Pakistan and Iraq, in Afghanistan, are suffering oppression and grievances. They're being attacked by this tyrannical force, as he would describe it, that is the West.
Now, are you saying this, or is he saying this, or I just want to be
this
clear.
This is, I think, the standard jihadi message.
Okay.
Above anything that you see in jihadi literature is this constant reference to Muslims being under oppression and Muslims being attacked.
And oppression so not by their own local governments or their own states,
right.
but by the United States?
Yeah, the United States, I think, in a grand sense, that's supporting Israel, that's attacking, that's at war with Muslims in Afghanistan and Iraq. That, in other words, the United States has Muslim blood on its hands, and that Muslim individuals need to stand up and support their brothers and sisters who are dying overseas. So how to do this then becomes a question of attacking locally, attacking, like we saw a member of parliament, Stephen Timms, or attacking, a local recruiting center in the United States.
Baltimore last week.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Precisely. And so, he isn't, in a sense, he isn't really saying anything new. I think it's the style that he has. He's charismatic. And going back to his rise in popularity in the I'd say late 1990s, early 2000s, it's always been a question of him being able to reach out to youth, being able to connect to youth. And the majority of his sermons are not about jihad or about political awareness or about these grievances even per se, but they're about spirituality and they're about connecting Muslims, Muslim youth in particular, to Islam in a time of estrangement, in a time where they're not necessarily connected to their religion. So he's been able to do that with great success. And then as he became more radical, he started to tie his message into this political awareness of defending your brothers and sisters who are dying overseas.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about homegrown terror threats in America and the common thread back to one man in Yemen, an American, Anwar al-Awlaki. Scott Chain joins us from the New York Times, covers national security there, and Chris Heffelfinger from West Point at the Combating Terrorism Center at the U.S. Military Academy. Here's the news headline from CBS just last week about the alleged thwarted plot in Baltimore with a connection through inspiration to al-Awlaki.
Another case of suspected homegrown terror. Another U.S. citizen plotting to blow up Americans. Today it was 21-year-old Antonio Martinez, a.k.a. Mohammed Hussein, a recent convert to Islam, arrested by federal agents this morning after attempting to detonate a car bomb outside this Armed Forces Recruiting Center in Maryland.
SUV stuffed with explosives. This young man, an immigrant from Nicaragua, or Nicaraguan-American, was told. But he pressed the button. Nothing happened. It was an FBI setup. There have been a lot of those. Here's a little bit more from al-Awlaki himself. Again, from that March 2008 lecture, It's a War Against Islam, urging Muslims to defend themselves against the United States or risk losing everything.
As Muslims, if we allow this to continue, if we do not stop it, it ain't gonna stop. It's not gonna stop. If you don't stand up in this struggle and make your voices heard and unite and make it clear to the authorities that you're not gonna allow your necks to be stepped over and your rights to be infringed upon, if you do not do that, then only Allah knows where it's gonna stop. Maybe the next day the Congress will pass a bill that Islam is illegal in America.
You hear just how American it comes across there. If we do not stop it, it ain't going to stop. And that from American Yemeni, Anwar al-Awlaki. Now, we're trying to look at this and understand it. There are interesting, to say the least, civil rights issues here around this kill order. There have been questions raised in the Islamic community about the FBI's, what must be an enormous underground effort going on in mosques around the country. We'll hear from a Muslim American leader on that front later in this hour. This is not about demonizing Islam. This is a holiday week, a holy week for Islam, Ashura this week. We're respected to our fellow Muslim citizens. We celebrate that with you. And at the same time, we're just trying to understand what is going on here. Scott Chain, What about the target on this man's back? The ACLU's fighting that. They're saying, come on, he's an American. What are we doing here? What's the justification that's put forward by President Barack Obama's administration?
Well, before I get to that, let me just correct one thing, Tom. That talk by Alki that we've been listening to is actually from March 2002, and it's sort of a crucial one because it's sort of a turning point for him. It's the first time he came out and said publicly that the U.S. was at war with Islam, but it was in the context of a series of raids that had – this was, of course, a few months after 9/11 – and there was a series of raids in mostly in Northern Virginia but also elsewhere in the country against Muslim institutions. And Alki at that time was the imam in a large mosque outside Washington in the Virginia suburbs and had ties and acquaintances with a lot of the people who were targeted in these raids. And when you listen to that talk, he's furious. And for the first time, he's talking in these fairly extreme terms. But he also cites in that same talk Malcolm X, and he talks about the American Civil Rights Movement and the fact that African Americans had to stand up and defend their rights and, you know, claim their rights. And he was sort of calling on Muslims to do the same thing. But it was very much in a kind of nonviolent American context. From there, he's gone on to a far more radical stance. And that is what has put, as you said, the target on this man. He was largely seen as an inspirational figure, as you've said, I'd say until the Christmas attempted bombing of the Christmas of the airliner on Christmas.
The so-called underwear bomber.
Detroit. Mm-hmm. The underwear bomber, exactly. That was a young Nigerian man who, had, according to his own account, had been trained in Yemen and equipped in Yemen, and he has told authorities that that Anwar al-Awlaki himself, played a role in that. And, we've been told by American intelligence officials that they believe al-Awlaki at that point became operational, as they call it. And he was no longer just talking. He was actually, recruiting, training, encouraging, perhaps not, designing mm-hmm. bombs, but playing a direct role in a plot against the United States. And at that point, as we understand it, there began to be a secret sort of series of discussions inside the government. And sometime early in 2010, he was put on, became the first American citizen to be put on the CIA's capture or kill list. as you said, the ACLU filed a lawsuit against that action, challenging that action, in the name of Nasser al-Awlaki, who is Anwar's father, mm-hmm. The man I mentioned as a prominent citizen. He was essentially saying, he was standing in for his son to challenge this decision to target him. And a judge just recently threw that case out, essentially on the grounds that both the father did not have the right to file suit on behalf of the son, and secondly, that essentially this should be an executive branch decision or perhaps a congressional decision, but not a decision by the courts to decide who gets targeted in what the administration characterizes as a war.
So could he be killed now by a sniper or a predator, drone or any way the CIA, by any means they have available? Is that the green light?
That's what we're told. It's all a secret process, but that is what we and others have reported, and we believe it to be true. Of course, in Pakistan, there's been this drone war conducted by the mm-hmm. CIA for some years now, where they've killed hundreds of suspected militants. This one stands out largely because not only because of Awlaki's prominence, but because he's an American citizen. And the suggestion that if the government secretly decides that you are a terrorist, even if you're an American citizen, and even if you're away from any war zone, that they have the right to kill you. That's, to put it mildly, a fairly seems on the face of it a fairly extreme claim. but it's one that's now been upheld by the courts.
Chris, Gregory Johnson was writing recently in the New York Times, and he said, you know, the United States is making a mistake here by going after Anwar al-Awlaki. They're building him into something that he isn't, that he needn't be, writing he's not the head of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. He's not the deputy commander. He's not the top religious scholar. He's a mid-level religious functionary, Johnson says, you know, this is a mistake. We've got listener, here's Steve, a listener on Facebook, says, unless he poses an imminent threat, which hasn't been asserted by the government, I think it's outrageous, I guess, the capture or kill order. Is this man, does he pose an imminent threat to the United States, Chris?
No, I don't think he poses any a threat in an operational sense. That's true. And Greg is right on that. He certainly isn't a leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. He hasn't been. But he's been used to their advantage. I think they've used him very effectively in their media, in statements and in this Inspire magazine that they've issued, where they can play up having an American defector, someone who has lived in America, who was a prominent imam in San Diego and Colorado, mm-hmm. and then Northern Virginia, and decided to leave all of that and become increasingly an advocate for, now most recently in his November 9th statement, calling on Muslims to kill Americans wherever you find them.
But is this like blaming Tokyo Rose, World War II Japanese propagandist, like blaming Tokyo mm-hmm. Rose for World War II, for the war in the Pacific?
I think that's a reasonable way to approach it. But more pragmatically speaking, I think killing him would be disastrous. It would go against what we're trying to achieve here, in that he would become a martyr. His video statements, audio statements around the web are going to continue to be there, and they would probably, you know, his popularity would only grow.
And you're at West Point saying that. I guess the CIA is not listening to you, Chris.
Well, I should say I'm not speaking on behalf of the U.S. Army here. This is just my personal views. But no, I think there is a failure to look at this in a long-term strategic sense. And, you know, he's above all a very effective motivational speaker for jihad. But killing him isn't going to weaken al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in any meaningful way. It certainly isn't. And it's only going to you know, to increase his popularity.
On the other hand, as you say, he's calling for this kind of lone wolf action. I mean, he says in the video that came out, November 8th, just last month, don't consult anyone mm-hmm. in killing Americans. Fighting Satan doesn't require a religious ruling. And if these alleged thwarted attempts by the FBI are the real deal, we are seeing what feels like a lot of them, Chris.
There are. I think what these cases show more than anything is that this ideology is being picked up on. And, you know, we hear a lot about radicalization. I think the term has been used more and more in the media over the past few years. And there isn't a good understanding, maybe there isn't any understanding of what the radicalization process actually is. But in a very basic sense, it's a process whereby individuals are being inducted into this ideology, are internalizing it, and then over a period of time being convinced that violent action is the only just action moving forward on there. And so, you know, he's been very effective in bringing people from being inspired by the idea of jihad and by the Mujahideen and being in support of their brothers and sisters to actually doing something. Now, this notion of don't consult with anyone, I think, mm-hmm. is very significant. All of the jihadi strategists in the early 2000s would have disagreed with this statement very strongly. You know, radicalization, as we saw it then, was a much longer process. People might have studied this form of Islam, Salafi Islam, for a year or two or three, and jihadi strategists would have insisted that to be a meaningful participant in jihad, you needed to have a solid understanding. You needed to have mm-hmm. solid religious education in order to be an effective member so that you wouldn't make basic mistakes and harm the movement.
Now he's saying it doesn't require a religious ruling. Just do it.
Yeah, he's saying just go out. And so in a sense, you have, you know, like pre-approval. You no longer – and so many of the cases that we saw, they got tied up when, you know, there would be a small group of individuals. The Fort Dix case was one, the Portland Six. these were, you know, mid-2000s cases where a small group of individuals got together, they had similar thinking, and they arrived at the end point that they needed to do something. They may have even plotted out what their action may have been, but they got held up in looking for a fatwa or a religious edict that supported their action, that approved it and said this is Islamically justifiable. In a sense, now he's giving that pre-approval for you. You know, you no longer need to shop around for an imam to support you. You've already got that.
There's a blank check, so you go. Let's get our listeners in here. Omaha, Nebraska. Shafiq, thanks for calling. Shafiq, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say I'm a Muslim myself, and mm-hmm. I have been listening to Anwar al-Awlaki before, and it pains to see that his views have been clouded only recently when he went to Yemen and he was in prison in a solitary confinement for 9 months. And I think his personal views came before making decisions, because mm-hmm. he has been preaching even before that. And as Muslims, we have listened to it and never, jihadi thoughts have came into our mind. That was the last thing that would have come.
A lot of his preaching, Shafiq, was very straightforward about how to live, how to live a good life, how to live a moral life, as I look back here, I see.
Correct.
So, Shafiq, help us. Do you understand, have you heard his message more lately, this much more violent message, and do you understand how it would, worm its way into the mind of young Americans?
Correct. Actually, I think one time he talked about the message where he said, whoever insults the Prophet ﷺ, he should be killed. I think that's when it kind of shocked me, because he has never talked in this manner, and I kind of tried to understand, what was it? Why was he coming from that background?
Mm-hmm.
And they actually released an interview after that solitary confinement he had, and he felt that he was wrongly imprisoned. And it feels to me that he's kind of coming back from a retaliation point,
mm-hmm.
and that is why this is what's happening. And right now, it seems to me very dramatic that I probably think everybody would know the movie Born Identity, where he's trying to fight back for his own identity. And it kind of took a wrong turn, I guess.
Well, Shafiq, you're sitting there in Omaha watching this. You sound like a reasonable man. What do you think the United States should be doing here? How can we, diminish the appeal of this man who's calling for violence within the borders of this country, not least? How?
Well, I think it's very difficult to do at this point, because Muslims all over the world are fighting the stigma that they're the terrorists. And it goes from all walks of, Muslims from mm-hmm. all walks of life. They are trying to fight the stigma that they're not a terrorist. Some try to do this by blending in. Some try to do this by standing out. And some try to do this by, following some preacher and, try to fight for it.
What do you tell kids in your community? What do you tell, teenagers in your community who may be, drawn romantically or, for some reason to Al-Awlaki's message?
Well, that is a very difficult thing to do right now, and I think it's the community's outreach that would help it. And Muslims, as any other, community members, because Muslims are not just a recent phenomenon, have been in existence since 1400 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's the recent tensions and all that, and how it is presented, under the lens that causes this effect.
Shafiq, I'm very grateful for your call and your insights there, and wish you good luck in your community and beyond your community. Thank you very much for calling us, Shafiq.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Shane, there's a voice from kind of the middle of America saying this man didn't always have this message, but now it's out there and it's difficult to deal with.
Yeah, one fascinating aspect of Awlaki's biography is that he had a sort of entrepreneurial streak, another thing that's somewhat American about him. I'm told that he used to go to sort of get-rich-quick seminars and that kind of thing. But he actually began a business of selling his lectures on CDs in 2000 that was extremely successful.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about homegrown terror threats alleged in America and the common thread alleged, back to one man in Yemen, an American, Anwar al-Awlaki. Scott Shane joins us from the New York Times, covers national security there. Chris Heffelfinger is with us from West Point, the Combating Terrorism Center at the U.S. Military Academy. His forthcoming book is Radical Islam in America, Salafism's Journey from Arabia to the Midwest. Joining us right now as well from Washington, and we're glad to have him with us, is Nihad Awad, Executive Director and co-founder of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, a Muslim advocacy group. Nihad Awad, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's start with the FBI alleged thwarted bombing attempts. We've seen a kind of string of them in recent weeks and months. Baltimore last week, Portland, Oregon, the Christmas tree lighting before that, the subway system, we're told, in Washington, D.C. before that. Leaving Awlaki out of this for a minute, just this string of allegations, are you buying it? Does it sound reasonable? Does this look like young Muslim Americans, you know, stepping up under whatever influence and really seriously trying to pull off the bombings that we're hearing so much about on television, radio?
I think there is a problem, and I also believe that this problem is not as widespread as we are led to believe through the media exposure and sometimes the over-politicizing of this issue. That does not mean that there is an insignificant problem. It is there. It is growing, but I think it has to be put in proper context. Our approach to deal with this issue has to be balanced and has to be comprehensive. And I would suggest that maybe it should include at least, you know, 4 points. One, theological refutation, so that we produce and introduce a counter-narrative that these recruited young men are used to believe in. And second, we have to look at what's going on in the world. What's leading some of these people to be recruited? And we have to think about political settlement for the wars that are taking place and look at some of the policies that some of these recruiters are using young people.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been seeing some of these video messages. They use current events to motivate young people to be misled into action. And thirdly, there should be a serious partnership between the community and parents to detect, prevent, and intervene in the right time if something like this happened. And fourthly, we need serious and have a partnership that's built on trust between law enforcement and the community. And that relationship has suffered serious trust deficit and setback in the past few months and couple of years because of the tactics that we believe that have been very counterproductive.
Well, let me ask you about those. Please, you've got a final thought there, Mr. Awad?
Yeah. Finally, I would say language, terminology, and mm-hmm. communication is very, very important. The way we analyze things, the kind of language we use, are we helping mm-hmm. The situation to be better, or are we adding fuel to the fire? And I can give you some specific examples, but go ahead.
We can well imagine those. I hope we get to talk about them. But again, Awlaki aside for a moment, you know, one of the things that strikes a layperson looking at this series of allegedly thwarted serious attempts, if these young people really thought, you know, they were going to blow up a good sized bomb with the Christmas tree lighting going on, I mean, it's kind of horrifying. Makes you wonder how many informants the FBI must have out there if there's, you know, if this is something they're on top of all over the place. I mean, what is your sense of how the FBI's tactics are working these days, Nihad, in the Muslim community?
I think it's a very critical and sensitive issue. We are all in agreement that law enforcement has to be effective mm-hmm. to prevent crimes and the killing of innocent people from taking place. We may have a disagreement over some of these tactics because some of these tactics make things worse and they are counterproductive. And I'll give you an example. In the news we've seen lately in the Washington Post report two Sundays back that the FBI has used an agent provocateur who was a convicted criminal, was implanted in the community as a recent convert. He took the faith of declaration of faith with the imam in front of hundreds of people, and he was seen and treated as a member of the community. And soon they started to feel that he was provoking and inciting violence among young people. When the members of the community reported him to the FBI, nothing was done, and they found out that he was an FBI informant. Now, imagine if, God forbid, that the next episode happens to be with a real terrorist, mm-hmm. and if the community feels that this could be an FBI informant and they don't come forward to tell the FBI about it, we're going to be in trouble.
Stand by for just a moment, Nihad, if you would. Chris Heffelfinger, I mean, you schooled the FBI in part on how to identify militant Islam and deal with it, I guess. You hear that concern that Nihad's expressing about, you know, if you've got people kind of provocateurs, essentially. On the other hand, if these lone wolf attacks are really brewing out there, it can seem like a godsend if they get interrupted. How do you think the FBI is doing in their tactics at this point, Chris?
Well, I should say the instruction that we provided was really aimed at understanding Islam from Islam 101 sort of thing moving forward. And so,
not so tactical, maybe.
Yeah, not on tactics at mm-hmm. all. But I think that effort is absolutely critical, and I think it's been beneficial overall in that now there is a this generation of FBI agents who are much better informed about Islam and able to understand it. But that aside, I think Mr. Awad raises a valid concern here that a relationship with the Muslim community is essential, and the FBI's work is not just about running informants and picking out what are not, you know, terribly high-level threats here. These aren't professional jihadis who are infiltrating mosques across America. These are people who are have become susceptible, these suspects that we've seen in the last, you know, half dozen cases here over 2010. These are people who have become susceptible to the jihadi message.
Yeah, but that sounds kind of blasé if they were intending to do what we're told they were intending to do, blow up a plaza full of people, blow up a recruiting center. You could picture a lot of deaths. Are you saying that they wouldn't actually have done that unless they were sort of pushed forward by the FBI?
I think that
if they were ready, it's kind of scary.
It is scary. It is scary, absolutely. And I think that, you know, their intent there is should have been concerned. I don't think that they would have been able to move from latching onto that message to manufacturing a bomb on their own or forming a cell. I mean, what we saw in the earlier part of this decade is that process took months, sometimes a couple years, to come to fruition. And these are happening very rapidly. You know, these are sort of turning around in a couple months. And so in part that might be that, you know, as we were discussing earlier, the radicalization process online seems to be accelerating itself. And so I think that the FBI is doing a good job here of being able to identify these threats effectively. Now, you know, the one thing I think we need to be concerned about, need to be looking at longer term, mm-hmm. is what, on the whole, what message is this sending back to the international community? What message is this, are all these arrests sending? And in the most recent issue of Inspire magazine, there is an effort to say, to put forward the message that there's a groundswell of jihadis in America who are coming up. And so I think, you know, in my personal view, it might be worth considering a quieter approach to this. Because on the one hand, we're perpetuating this idea that, you know, that the ranks of the jihadis are swelling in the United mm-hmm. States. And secondly, we are damaging relations with the Muslim community.
But when you say quieter approach, I mean, what I can't quite figure out is if the FBI is sort of leading these young guys by the hand, you know, into the SUV full of fake explosives, or would they have done it anyway? And if they would have done it anyway, there's no way you can really pull back from stopping it. And it's a big deal when it stopped, right? How do you get quieter here? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, one idea would be to monitor these individuals for a longer period rather than try to bring the case to a head. You know, these are two different tactics. I'm not in a position to say which is better or which the law enforcement community
is. So you're suggesting the FBI is bringing them to a climax, bringing them to these dramatic moments that we then hear all about on television.
That seems to be the case from mm-hmm. just my reading of news reports. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now, you know, looking back again to these cases we saw in the 2000s, what would happen is an individual who had this mindset would typically remove themselves from the mosque, remove themselves from their local community, mm-hmm. and form a small group of guys mm-hmm. who got together and eventually... Now, you know, I think those posed, in a sense, a greater threat because there was a plot of, you know, outside of any... for at least for a period, this was taking place outside of law enforcement monitoring, mm-hmm. and they were trying to acquire bombs or acquire weapons in order to carry out an attack. You know, my only thought on these individuals who have been arrested more recently, into however we want to call it, stings or, you know, with the use of informants, is that they had no training in jihad or in militant activity whatsoever. It was always a prerequisite that an individual, once they sort of pursued this ideological path and were willing to use violent action, that they went to Pakistan or Yemen to get, you know, basic paramilitary training to understand bomb making, etc. So these are people, you know, in a sense, though, this is what we terrorism analysts have been and researchers have been encouraging from the beginning, is the sooner that you can identify these individuals and get to them, the sooner you can cut off lessen the risk and hopefully cut off the threat.
And we're just trying to figure out what's going on, because now here you've got your Al-Awlaki and others saying just go for it, I guess, and the FBI then ready to sort of maximize, help them, you know, have that big SUV at the recruiting center door. And pretty soon, you know, we're all just thinking, what is going on here? Nihad Awad, how do you deal with an internet that is full of these kind of messages? You know, for young people in your community, we all know what young people are like. They're impressionable. There are big stresses and tensions in the world. They surely go online. It's easy to see this stuff. I mean, how does a Muslim family deal with this? If a teenage son is, you know, becomes kind of interested in what Al-Awlaki is saying, and he's saying pretty violent things now.
That's what I really wanted to say. First of all, as I said, political settlement to conflicts like war in Iraq and in Afghanistan are very, very important, because the terrorists have been using current events and these conflicts in recruiting young people. And also we have to allow more freedom to discuss political issues and foreign policy in our mosques, in our congregations, in our conventions, within our organizations, without being chilled, without being intimidated. Because if we do not allow this freedom of discussion, and the Muslim community can contribute a lot to aligning our foreign policy with our values, if we do not allow this freedom to take shape the way it has been taking shape in America for hundreds of years, these young people will go somewhere else to listen, to talk, and the cyberspace is one venue where they will be preyed on. But also allow me to introduce just a caution and a suggestion. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I heard Chris, you know, saying the word jihad and radical Islam, and in my earlier comment I said we have to look at communication and language and terminology. Jihad, and my opinion might not be popular on the show, but I hope people can understand where we come from. The jihad is a religious concept in Islam, fighting oppression, helping the weak, and we should not use this term to equate it with terrorism. I'm glad to see that the U.S. government just recently, months ago, acknowledged that terrorism and jihad are not equivalent. If we refer to the terrorists as jihadists, we are giving them credit. We are giving them legitimacy.
But what do we do when the terrorists themselves, or Al-Awlaki in this case, he certainly links terror and jihad?
We should not repeat their propaganda, and we should not give them the legitimating titles and the PR that they don't deserve.
We take your point. Let me ask you this question. If we wake up one morning and the headline is, you know, Anwar al-Awlaki killed by, let's say, predator drone in Yemen, U.S. claims, does that help simmer down what's going on, or does it build the fire higher, Mr. Awlaki?
I think more important than this, and of course, you know, I'm not an analyst to predict the reaction or the impact of this of his killing, if it comes, you know, to take place. I as some of your commentators earlier said, they believe, and I believe that it's a mistake to go that route. But I think what is more important is to produce and introduce a counter-narrative, a theological refutation to the misuse of the text. And we should all stop the Islamization of this conflict or the Islamization of terrorism and violence. I think if we commit this mistake, we draw more mainstream Muslims into seeing America and seeing all of us as part of the conflict instead of seeing as part of the solution. So language and terminology sometimes is very, very critical because it may portray our discussion and our point of views in a way that maybe we don't intend to say or do.
Our time is short. I want to go to Scott Shane. Forgive me. Scott, a counter-narrative, do you see the U.S. national security apparatus going for that or going for the kill?
Well, I think probably both. There is a great deal of discussion about what the U.S. government could do in counter-radicalization, but there's also great wariness because at some level it appears to be, promulgating a particular version of a religion, which, of course, in our history and the separation of church and state is anathema.
Well, we are up against some kind of tangle here. I think we understand it better after this hour, and we're grateful for that. Nihad Awad, Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Thank you very much for being with us today, Mr. Awad. And Chris Heffelfinger at West Point at the Combating Terrorism Center at the U.S. Military Academy. Chris, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Scott Shane with the New York Times, thanks for your reporting and insights. Thanks for being here, Scott.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.